Marcus Samuelson has had an interesting path to becoming one of the most celebrated chefs and restaurateurs in the country. He was born in Ethiopia, adopted by a Swedish couple, and eventually moved to Manhattan. He became executive chef at one of the city's hippest restaurants, which catapulted him to culinary stardom. This allowed Samuelson to open restaurants throughout the city, most notably Harlem's Red Rooster. He recently released the Red Rooster cookbook, The Story of Food and Hustle in Harlem. Let's listen to a portion of our talk recorded back in February. What was the thinking, though, behind Red Rooster? And I was reading that after September 11th, you, I think, like a lot of other people, began to kind of think about their life, what they were doing, what they wanted to do. It sounds like this restaurant kind of grew out of some of that tragedy and some of your thinking.
Well, I mean, I think we're all, as creative people, we all sort of reflection of these larger moments that happen in society and how do they impact us and how do we come back to our community with a response that makes sense, maybe only for yourself, but hopefully other people can gravitate to it. And I'm an immigrant to this country, and it's fascinating. We're talking about this as this very intense moment of diversity and immigrants and refugees. I'm not a refugee. I'm very privileged in that sense to be an immigrant. And I come because it's easier very often to be an immigrant versus a refugee. And like most immigrants, you're in love with America, the idea of America, and you fight for it. And you're very often extremely patriotic about this new country that you that accepted you. So I came to this America with this idea of diversity and this idea of that I wanted to contribute to the landscape of cooking more than just filling people into my restaurant. And that's something obviously that is important. But besides that, what else could one contribute and share? And after 9/11, I felt like, you know what, I should probably, my energy was at the lowest, and I was really searching. So I said, you know what, let's leave where I'm living right now. Let's move to Harlem, and let's learn about that community. And maybe, maybe one day I open a restaurant. And it was through talks to me with my mother that she always said to me that, Marcus, why do we always have to leave our communities to eat your food? She was talking to us as a family. Why do you always trust just bankers' taste versus you didn't grow up with bankers. You grew up with school teachers. You grew up with bus drivers. You grew up with all kinds of people. So she was constantly challenging me to do something affordable within the community. And out of this idea, that's where Red Rooster came to. And then also that I wanted also, as I learned about Harlem, that desperation of, can we change the foot traffic of dining? Can people come into urban communities such as Harlem versus just having all the experiences downtown or elsewhere?
You have a great paragraph in here about Harlem. You say, right now, Harlem is delicious. Mm-hmm. And then you describe, in a sense, looking out your standing at your doorway, looking up the street and then down the street and just seeing this world that seems very uniquely Harlem.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Harlem has always been a very diverse community. I think it's important to sort of go back. The restaurant is about connecting the past with the present, and thereof we create something for the future. So, you know, if you go to East Harlem, it's always been Italian-American, and you have restaurants such as Rayo's and Patsy's that comes out of there. And you go further in, you have El Barrio, which was always Latin, Puerto Rican, and today is a Mexican-American community predominantly. In the center of Harlem, obviously, it's the roots of the migration, the African-American story coming up, the laborer coming up. And out of that, we got jazz to incredible storytellers in terms of music and writers, of course. And then to the west, it's gone everything from being Irish-American to very diverse communities. So the restaurant celebrates all of that movement. So I think the migration is the core, but also global immigration. So now West Harlem has little West Africa, has a Caribbean community, and also a lot of New Yorkers that moved in too. So the restaurant will always sort of keep its pulse and its core around the foods and the culture around the migration. But we will also have Chinese New Year. We will also celebrate Swedish Midsummer because we can, and it's delicious and it's fun.
I noticed that you have about a third of the people sitting in your restaurant are walk-ins.
Yes.
And again, that seems like such a sort of nitpicky detail. Mm-hmm. Why is that important, though?
Our first week when we opened, our restaurant was packed, and a lot of people looked into the window, and they looked kind of like, oh, it's a restaurant for them. Yeah. And who are them? And what I realized was a friend of mine just said to me, Marcus, I live in this community. I'm not going to make a reservation to your restaurant. I might come home back from work. I'm tired. I may be 15, 20 minutes late. If you're going to be in my community, and it's for me, I want to be able to walk in. That's my prerogative and privilege. And I realized also the buy-in of the community. Success would be the buy-in of the community, not just me as a chef coming and implementing my 10 best dishes. So this pushback of letting me know what was up, completely complaining to me and telling me what I needed to do, I loved that. I was like, wow, I've been thinking about this wrong. So this wasn't that this great idea that I figured out before. The success of Red Rooster is also, it's an imperfect endeavor where we constantly have to pivot and change and listen to the community. So we decided, okay, we'll look at a reservation book. A third of those calls are New Yorkers, and New Yorkers are very simple. They say, give me a reservation
at
8
o'clock
right now. And we don't have that. It's like, don't you know who I am? It's very difficult.
I'm sure.
The visitors... You know, they say, hey, let's go to New York. And the second night, let's go to Harlem. They mostly do that reservation online.
Right.
So then we were able to know, okay, we have the X amount of online reservation, X amount of phone calls. Let's just see and open up. And that's why we have this extremely diverse population in there. You know, it's like a Steve Bannon nightmare, right? It's all kinds of people.
A Steve Bannon.
Yeah, it's like all kinds of people getting along, having a good
time. What a horrible thing,
oh my
right?
God.
It's terrible.
And then we're having fun, and people are hugging and speaking different languages and laughing. And some of them, I'm going to tell you, you don't know this, but there's actually black people sitting next to white people.
I don't believe it.
So this
I
is
do
a
not
little,
believe that.
It's a little
Never
bit.
Happened.
It's a secret that I want you to know. And there's Chinese people, and there's like, it is all kinds of people. And sometimes they get drunk, and sometimes they go home together.
Oh,
it's
my goodness.
Horrible. I can't stop there.
Well, there's your logo, Steve Bannon's Nightmare, the
Red
Rooster.
I don't want to give him too much credit for that. People love it.
And there was a Red Rooster in Harlem,
yes.
Right? I mean, going back to the 30s, the Prohibition
days? When I searched for the name, I wanted to have something that a Harlemite knew that this is in and of Harlem. There's a lot of stuff in Harlem and not that many things that are in and of the community. So, and I also wanted a name where these other places like Cotton Club and so on, black people were allowed to work, but they were not allowed to be guests. So I didn't want to have anything that had that stigma around it. And one of the things that I loved about Red Rooster was a tiny little bar right next to Abyssinia Church. And I read this story about it, and it was this bartender, George, and I said, do you see the hustlers, the police officers and the politicians? He said, I've had them all. And I love that because the show indicated to me that it was a gay bar, and they were called funny people back in the day.
Funny people.
Which I didn't know. And I just thought that was, wow, well, I know a lot of funny people and I love them. And there was also where politicians could go. So a young Charlotte Rangel and Dave Dinkins went there. But it was also where the maid, when they had the maid nights on Thursday, maids came from all over the New York area to go to the Red Rooster. And it was also where Willie Mays and Nat King Cole, before they went on downtown. So it was this place was very diverse. And I was like, wait a minute. I know the artist. I know the community. Let's create a place that is in and of Harlem that also matches this magical energy that Lenox Avenue provides to you, that is extremely diverse, that we have to hold on to and celebrate and don't take for granted.
You mentioned your grandmother, Helga. I mean, it seems like she was, and you wrote about her in your memoir, she was someone that really inspired you to cook, to be a chef perhaps, to travel the world, to be open to taste.
My grandmother, Helga, comes from a time when Sweden was poor, which is kind of hard for people to understand that Sweden was a poor country. It was a very poor country. She only had 6 years of education, and she was an amazing cook. She had a world review through her daughter and through my father. And when he came back and we came back from trips, we had to sit down and explain what was the food in France? What could we eat in Italy? and she wanted to make the pasta the way it was done in Italy. She had her Escoffier book translated. And when I lived in Switzerland, my Sunday calls to her, I have to put in coins, and I have to go by minute telling her about purple carrots. She's like, how can carrots be purple? I have to tell her about how she couldn't understand that we didn't use the pig feet. Well, how come you don't use them? What happens to the pig feet? Because this was all foods. That was, if you had an animal, you used everything. And she's like, well, how can you get fresh fish in a place where it's landlocked? These were the things that I was talking to my grandmother about. So, yes, she hadn't traveled, but she connected me constantly to a time of eating well, but yet being poor. Those two things was where she came from, but we always ate well.
This is a story you have told a lot, but I think it fits nicely into the conversation that we're having about the fact that you were born in Ethiopia.
Yeah.
You and your mom and your sister had to walk something like 75 miles in order to get treatment for TB?
Yeah, my mother did not survive, but she was strong enough to walk me and my sister from our tiny little village into the capital. Yeah. And, you know, when I look at, when I go back to Africa and I, you know, this idea of you, I've never seen a picture of my mother. I've never seen her eyes. So when I go back to Africa and I look at a 20-something young woman with two kids, I sometimes think about, could that have been my mother? Well,
sure.
That's how she looked like. I think about the dry food that she carried with her on the journey, and we ate at night because it was a little bit colder. And then getting to the hospital, getting into the hospital, and on top of that, how did we get adopted? You know, there's 5,000 kids in there, and how did my sister put us, you know, on top of the line there? There's so many things.
Is that what your sister did? She figured out, and your sister is older.
A little bit
than
older
you.
Than me, yes. But it's also the goodness of others, right? There was a nurse there that had three kids on her own, and when we recovered from TB after a couple of months, they said, "What are we doing with these kids?" Which is a very common thing. There's thousands of kids. Well, they don't have any parents. She just said, "I'll take them in until we set up a way for them to get adopted."
You were pretty little. Do you have actual memories, or is it your sister sort of remembering for you?
It's all really memories that my older sister had really talked to us and talked to me about, and, you know, it's sort of been in stamped with us in terms of. And when I go back to Ethiopia today, it's a place that me and my wife, we go back to every year, and we have our own charity, Three Goats, where we help young children with food and water and so on. But it's really, it gives me such a source of both pride, but also strength. You know, when I go into the hut that we was born, that's actually the same size of this table. And I think about that I was
about
born
six
in a
feet
hut.
By 4 feet.
Yeah, with obviously no electricity and all that stuff. And we lived there, and I can be here sitting talking to you today. Mm-hmm. That shows that nothing is impossible.
That was my conversation with chef and restaurateur Marcus Samuelson, recorded back in February. When we get back from the break, we'll listen to my conversation with comedian Paula Poundstone. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Thanks again for joining us this Memorial Day. We're spending the hour replaying portions of some of our favorite shows. We turn now to my interview with comedian Paula Poundstone. She's been a prominent comic for years now, and she's a regular panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. She joined us earlier this month to talk about her recent attempts to find joy in life, which she wrote about in her new book, The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. In it, she talks about her various adventures in self-help, including excessive hugging, simple exercise, and treating herself to a day with a Lamborghini. We also talked about her personal life, her many cats, and her stand-up career. Let's take a listen. There are many emotions you could have researched: sadness, fear, surprise, disgust. You chose happiness. Why?
I think I'm going to do a book about surprise. I love
that
idea.
Wouldn't that be
good? Yeah, I'll just have people constantly jumping out at me until I'm a nervous wreck.
Why happiness?
Well, it's fun. That's the main reason. I think although a balance of all emotion, of course, is the healthiest way to go. I think the one that we, you know, that we that we're hoping we score big with is happiness. Plus, I just thought it would be, honestly, a really fun playground in which to write yet another memoir. I get to keep writing memoirs because I'm not yet dead. And so that gives me permission. And the question that I started out with was not whether or not I would enjoy doing any one of those things. I had a vague suspicion about what I would enjoy. But the real question was, what thing gives a lasting feeling where, you know, where there's some shelf life to it or provides an umbrella to the inevitable rains that are a part of everyone's daily life.
Indeed.
I mean, the truth is, if you're happy all day long, then you're likely daft.
There's something wrong with you.
More than likely. It isn't something that comes in 24-hour cases.
I'd love to have you actually read a section from the book where you decide to take Taekwondo classes. And the little post-it is there. You introduce us to your teacher.
Mr. Victor King was the instructor. He did a rapid pretend assault on these women, and they successfully deflected his blows, following up with a series of elbows to an inch before his nose and knees to an inch before his groin. They looked pretty advanced. They must have been learning to almost hit someone for quite a while. As a driver, I'm a natural at that. I was really intimidated watching them do it with hands and feet, though. I harbor a fantasy that since I don't like sex and therefore never seek it, perform it, look for it, dream about it, dress for it, hint about it, or purchase products that are sold by suggesting that if you own this thing, you'll get more of it, there must be some other unknown, untapped skill in life for which I have a gift. Deep down, I was hoping that, especially because I'd be an unlikely candidate, I'd do a kick or two and this Mr. King guy would say, "Whoa, I thought you said you had no prior training." "That's right," I'd reply. "Well, Miss Poundstone, is it? Normally, I start my students off at a beginner level, but I'm going to ask if you'll teach with me. I simply can't believe that you haven't kicked the stuffing out of a padded thing before."
That's Paula Poundstone reading from her new book. Where to start with that? I'll get to the part where you say you don't like sex. But how did things work out with Taekwondo?
Taekwondo was great. It was grueling. I was up to doing 500 rope jumps.
Rope jumps.
Yeah, and that's in a row. You know, I'll tell you one thing I figured, even now, and I haven't been doing, that was the Get Fit experiment, the first one in the book. I haven't been doing any kind of working out stuff in a long, long time. And just as I suspected, the weight that I lost came back and brought its friends.
I think you said you lost something like 12 pounds.
I did lose 12 pounds, yeah. And I really did feel good. And so it's natural to ask oneself, why then don't I just work out?
Right? And you'd feel better.
I would feel better. It's it's the cheese. It's not even a maze. It's a straightaway to the cheese. Just here it is, come get it. First of all, in terms of working, I really do have to have someone tell me what to do. It is just, there is no way that I'm going to jump rope until I'm about to vomit without someone else being my overlord. I just couldn't push myself that hard. It wouldn't even occur to me to do so. I would think, oh, since I'm about to vomit, I should stop, which I think is a natural thing that your body gives you. You need to hand your brain over to someone else when you're working out. I think, for me anyways.
Well, let's talk about the don't like sex part. Is that true?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's just not my area.
Was it ever your area?
No. No, actually. Have I experimented? Yes, I have. About every 10 or 15 years, I do an experiment, and so far I'm right.
This doesn't mean anything to you?
No, it really, and I'm happy for the rest of you. Don't get me wrong. It's not like a prudish thing. It's a lot of stuff. And it seems that I function so well without it. Why, you know? And, you know, the thing is, I don't even know how, you know, I am so busy and I work so hard. I mean, now my kids are young adults, but honestly, for years, I was a single working mom with, you know, various amounts of cats, like 16 cats, two German Shepherd mixed dogs. We had bunnies. I had one aunt left from my aunt farm for the longest time. The idea that I would go into my room at the end of the day and there'd be someone in there with whom I had to have an activity was just upsetting to me.
Are the cats a good substitute then?
Well, actually, I don't allow the cats in the bedroom. there's got to be one place where someone hasn't, you know, peed in a place they're not supposed to, and there's not, you know, fuzz all over everything. So I don't allow them in my bedroom, but I do sleep with two German Shepherd mixed dogs.
That'll keep a person out of your bed, right?
Yeah. Well, I don't even have a bed. I sleep on the floor with blankets.
Truly?
Yeah. I sleep on the wood floor. So
is that left over from ascetic period in your life?
No. Since high school, I just have much preferred the floor. In a hotel, like I'm staying in a hotel tonight, I stay in the bed in the hotel, but because I don't know where their floor has been. But at home, here's why. Because in the morning, I get up and I fold the blankets and I put them in a box. If that bedding were out all day long, I would never get out of it. So this way here, it's, you know, out of sight, out of mind, and I'm on with my day and I work really hard. But if I had like a nook or a cranny to lay down in, that would be the death of my productivity.
Well, I should add something to your sleep habits in that you drink, and we got you several cans of Diet Coke. Well, you have your own Diet Coke.
Where is it?
We will bring in your other cans of Diet Coke.
Tell the Sherpas to get in here with the...
but you keep a can of Diet Coke by, and you're just downing it, as I ask you, by your bedside. Yeah. So how do you sleep anyway if you're downing caffeine all day
You know
long?
What? It doesn't... I think I have to drink a lot of caffeine to even get to ground zero.
Really?
Yeah.
Just to kind of get revved up?
At one point I remember years ago I had the flu when it was going around, and my kids had the flu, and I took care of them, and then I fell prey to it myself. And everybody else recovered within a couple of days. And for me... even though I was still functioning and doing what I had to do, I was exhausted. I could barely make it off the floor. And I finally realized that, you know, one of the things that happens when you get the flu is things don't taste good anymore. It's part of the reason you don't eat so much when you have the flu is it just doesn't taste good anymore. So soda didn't taste good to me anymore. So I had stopped drinking diet soda. And I realized, okay, it's not that I'm sick anymore.
You need your caffeine.
I am having withdrawal.
Wow.
And as soon as I realized that, I had a good head start on kicking the habit. But I also had terrible headaches and stuff. And so I thought, you know what, forget it. And I just pounded it and was right back in the – so it takes me several doses of caffeine to even be like a normal person.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it doesn't – the stuff I drink at night doesn't keep me awake.
This is a kind of a serious question, but do you think comedians are more or less happy than anyone else?
No. I think that's an old wives' tale that that comics love. I mean, when I first started, I was so dramatic. I really bought into that idea that, you know, somehow it was the tears of a clown and that I had somehow suffered more than most. It was a rather pathetic notion, actually. No, I think if you want to find unhappiness, get a coal miner or someone who's just born into the world with a genetic predisposition for depression. I mean, a lot of depression, can it be caused by certain things? Absolutely. But it is also a condition that some people are just genetically, you know. So, no, I don't think that the comics are any more unhappy. The truth is, in fact, I think the opposite might be true, which is because the job that we do, regardless of what our normal state is, the job that we do is we get to go on stage and say things that we think are funny and be with a group of people who've come out to laugh for the night. And I can't really think of many more uplifting experiences. And it's, I consider myself a proud member of the endorphin production industry. And you really.
And we appreciate that.
Well, yes. You get a contact high from it, that's for sure. You know, so no, I don't think we're more unhappy than others.
But you do write in your book, negativity is practically my native language.
Well, that's
true. Where
does
that come from?
I don't know. I think maybe I just have allowed it more than others because I was watching an interview last night on the NewsHour with a soprano diva. A big one in New York, I guess, that is not going to do
Fleming,
that.
Somebody.
Yeah. And she was saying that she was talking about stage fright and that she, and this is a woman, you know, couldn't be more accomplished in her craft. And she was, and I don't know if she was saying she still had it, but she was talking about the times at which she did. And again, all that training, you know, you don't become an opera star without a tremendous amount of training. So you got, you know, as a comic, the training is that you go on stage and you do open mic nights and you, so you have to really be bad at it in front of people.
And that's how you learn to be good at it?
Right, exactly. As opposed to being something like an opera star. Now, I realize performing in front of people is different than not performing in front of people. But as an opera star, you would have the training that goes into it before you hit the stage. So there would be a reason to have some confidence in what you're doing. But what she was saying was, basically what I took away from it was just what a part of the human condition that is.
Sure.
Feeling of inadequacy, and people handle it in different ways, but I think we all have it.
You were, what, about 19 when you did your first stand-up routine? What was the routine, and what got you in front of the mic?
Well, I had wanted to be a comic, you know, for as long as I can remember, literally since kindergarten. I didn't know how to go about doing that. And really, I was very lucky. It was really just sort of time and place that a comedy scene began in Boston in the time while I lived there.
Wow.
I was bussing tables for a living. It's not like I turned my back on a law degree. I had wanted to be, you know, Carol Burnett or Mary Tyler Moore or Gilda Radner I'd want to be a comic actress. I still would like to do that, actually. But I didn't know from stand-up, and then I went with a friend to a club one night where there was a band playing, and there was a flyer on the wall saying that every other Sunday there was a comedy show there at this place. And so I went, and I saw that, and it wasn't very good, by the way.
No?
No, because those guys that were on that had really just started a couple of weeks ago. So you're not very good in a couple of weeks. It takes a lot. I'm a ascriber to the Malcolm Gladwell theory from Outliers, the book Outliers.
Yes.
He says that in order to be an expert at something, it requires, well, obviously access, so you are able to do the thing to begin with, but also the attitude with which you do it, and then 10,000 hours of practice.
Yeah, practice.
And so, you know, in 2 weeks, you're not a very good comic. But anyways, I went and I saw, and so I joined in and began doing open mic nights, and that's how you get good at doing this job. When you did an open mic night, the premise of open mic is that anybody who wants to can go on for 5 minutes, and especially back then, those nights, those open mic nights were the hottest night of the week. The crowds were hotter than even on a Saturday. And they would be like a Monday or a Wednesday. And partly because it was a deal for the audience. There was either no cover charge or it was very low. And, and every comic wanted practice time. They were just these raucous, crazy nights. I went to San Francisco, but in both cities, same deal. So many people are waiting to get on that if you went over that 5 minutes, I mean, you could hear the knives sharpening in the back. And I would memorize my act. If you watched me bussing tables during the day, you could see my lips moving because I was memorizing my act all the time. And, I'd type it out on the backs of obsolete menu placemats from the restaurant that I worked in. And I'd go on just really intending to do just that. And what would happen was I would get so nervous that I'd forget what I was going to say. And then I was stuck improvising basically. Or on my way up to the stage, even I would see something in the room that I thought was funny, and then I would blurt it out. And now, right off the bat, I have no idea where I am in the 5 minutes,
right.
And which would only make me more and more nervous. And so I kept thinking to myself, because it made everyone so mad when I would go over, that this was a terrible, terrible thing, that I wasn't sticking to my set. And I don't remember on what night or even what year it dawned on me that the real joy of what I do is when I don't stick to the set. So I got to a point where I allowed myself that freedom. I allowed myself to do stuff like lay down on the stage. But it took a while. I don't remember how long I had been at it before I really embraced. It was a little bit like Dumbo.
Oh, with the feather sort of jumping into the pool?
There's a great line in Dumbo. It's something, I gave my manager, who's the greatest manager in the world, I gave her a copy of a Disney, big picture book of Dumbo years ago, because Timothy Mouse was a fantastic manager. Oh. He says to Dumbo, when Dumbo ends up in the tree in the morning, and they don't realize right away what's happened, but then they figure out that in their drunken stupor, at some point Dumbo must have flown into the tree. And he says to Dumbo, when he realizes what happened, he says, the very thing that brought you down is going to bring you up, up, up. And so that was sort of, I figured that out somewhere along the way myself, which is this inability to stick to what I was supposed to say, which felt like a negative for so long. It turns out that's where the heart of the whole thing is. And when I work, I do have an act. I have many, many, many jokes. I've been at this for 38 years, and I think a lot of my material is pretty darn good. But the real joy of the evening is just talking to the audience. I do the time-honored, where are you from, what do you do for a living? And I allow whatever the person says to set my sails.
That was my interview with comedian Paula Poundstone about her new book, The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. When we get back from the break, we'll get some music and conversation from blues artist Ruthie Foster. Stay with us. This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Blues musician Ruthie Foster said she wanted to get back to the basics for her new record, Joy Comes Back. The album is primarily blues renditions of artists ranging from Mississippi John Hurt to Black Sabbath. It was recorded during a tough time in her life, and she says that making this record was like therapy for her. We talked about her youth in small-town Texas, her biggest influences, and her approach to recording and performing. Let's listen. So what brought your joy back?
Oh, you know, being in the studio and in the relaxed atmosphere, we recorded in my good friend Dan Barrett, who produced this album. He had the studio in a house in South Austin, and so I love sitting on his front porch just having coffee and, with him coming back from tours. But we just decided to put something down and off we went on this new album, this new trek.
Have you ever had you worked with him before?
No. He was one of the many Austin musicians that played around town. Porter Davis is the name of his trio. And he's a neighbor that lived around the corner.
Really?
Yeah, I was out watering my yard, and he was walking by the front yard with walking his kid. And we realized, gosh, we should probably just go have some coffee or something together.
Serendipity, right?
Yeah. That's kind of how it all happened. And I really wasn't ready to record. So we just struck up a friendship, and I would hang out at his house/studio. And that's how we started this.
There's so many interesting composers, I should say, on this album. You've got Chris and Sean Staples. You've got Grace Pettis. You've got Mississippi John Hurt, Stevie Wonder. You've got Black Sabbath. Curious about what attracts you to a certain kind of song. Is there a Ruthie Foster song?
Yeah, all kinds, all types, really. It was everywhere because it took this CD was about 3 years in the making. And so I was a little bit of everywhere. my mindset. You know, I remember being pretty burnt out from being on the road. So you see a little bit of that in some of the slower songs and softer approaches. And then, I'd get refreshed and I'm home for a while. I think I took the month of December off the year before last year. And, I went back in with the Christmas spirit and full of cheer. And then you hear some of that on the CD. It's a little bit of all sides of me, really, emotionally.
Well, it feels, having listened to it several times, I mean, it does feel very, I don't know you, but it feels very personal.
It is. I was just coming out of a long-term relationship in the middle of making this record, too. And that was really hard on my spirit. And going into the studio really helped me find some balance and of all things meaning for the music. You know, it gave me a place to put all of those feelings. And there's a lot of covers on this album because I wasn't in a place to write as much. Just didn't have the words. Sometimes you just don't have right. the words. But I found a lot of great songs that that said what I was really wanting to say. And songs I wish I'd written.
And songs you wish you'd written, of course. Like books I wish I'd written as well.
Oh, yeah.
You grew up in a little town, at least it was, mm-hmm. I guess, 500. That seems pretty little. Little town in Texas called Gauze, Texas. What was that like? What was that town like for you to grow up in?
It's small. Gauze was very much home in the way that if we got into trouble growing up, me and my brother, we would pass about 3-4 different neighbors who would, by the time I got home, my mother knew exactly what we were into because the neighbors would call my mother and let her know that we were somewhere we weren't supposed to be. It's a small town. Everybody knows everybody's business. But, you know, it was very much a community. I grew up, I was raised by the community. Hmm. I was raised by a lot of different households and I always felt safe. There was music around. My yeah. mother loved music, gospel, and my dad loved blues. So, you know, we had a little bit of everything in the house.
Were you a mischievous kid?
You know, I wasn't. I was a really good kid. It was my brother.
Of course. He dragged you into it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That's my story. I'm sticking to that. Yeah, we would get into a few things once in a while, but nothing really bad. You know, just being
stuff.
Kids.
You do come from a musical family, as I understand it. A lot of
gospel singers,
mm-hmm. right? Going both sides of the family?
Both sides of the family. My dad had uncles who sang and recorded a few albums. And on my mother's side, my mother was a singer. She sung with her sister. A lot of the Sister Rosetta Tharpe songs that she did with Marie Knight, they would do those same type of songs and sing harmony together. And I remember for a long time when, as an itty-bitty kid thinking that my mother was Aretha Franklin because she was a beautiful singer all the time. My mother sang when she was doing dishes and when she was just around the house, just had a beautiful voice. And because of that, I didn't really want to be a singer. I thought there were really great singers in my family. Why would I knock that? So I wanted to play piano or guitar. I wanted to hide behind an instrument.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
But clearly that didn't work out.
No, that didn't work out so much. But it's working out for me now. There's this thing that happens in my family where everybody has a rite of passage in the choir. We all sing. But there comes a time when you have to do a solo in the choir. And my turn came. I chose a song called Pass Me Not, O Gentle Savior. It's a hymn. And I remember looking in the amen corners, all these women and my grandmother, Big Mama, I called her. She was sitting over there and I saw her in my peripheral vision. I saw the hat lean forward and nod and smile and then lean back while I was singing. And I thought, okay, I'm going to be okay now. Big Mama, she just approved. Wow. I just got approved by Big Mama.
We are talking with Ruthie Foster. She's a blues artist. She's got a new CD called Joy Comes Back, and she has brought her guitar to our studio and is going to play something from her new CD, her new album.
Yeah, this is something written by Chris Stapleton. What are you listening to? I put that record on.
the sad song playing on a radio station. Tears still fall, heart still breaking, cause you're hanging on. Is it a love song about someone new? What are you listening to? Just like me, trying to figure out how a good thing goes bad. And I don't know, I can't let it go. Yeah, it's about to drive me mad. What are you listening to? Is it a cover band in some college town bar where it's not something to get you through? Just a sad song playing on a radio station. Tears still fall, heart still breaking, cause you're hanging on. Is it a love song about someone new? What are you listening to? Is it a feel-good song? Get you driving too fast? Past or the kind you can't help singing along, singing along. Is it headphones on a downtown train, a window seat in an outbound plane? Is it L.A., sunny or Memphis blue? I wish I knew, I wish I knew. What are you listening to? Is it a cover band or some college town bar where it's not something to get you through? Just a sad song playing on a radio station. Tears still fall, heart still breaking, cause you're hanging on. Is it a love song about someone new? What are you listening to?
Our guest, Ruthie Foster, song "What Are You Listening To" by Chris Stapleton. That was wonderful.
Thank you.
That was just wonderful. Thank you so much. Let me just make sure that our listeners can join our conversation. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times Music and Conversation this hour with blues artist Ruthie Foster. So how long have you been playing the guitar?
You know, I started about 11 years old. Yeah, I'm 53 now, so I've been doing
long
it for
time.
A while.
Did you have one of those little guitars, or were you a little girl with a gigantic guitar?
I had a little guitar. My dad got me a cute little something from I don't even know where. And it was cute the way he wrapped it, because he's a terrible gift wrapper. And so he wrapped it so that most of the guitar was in the box, but the head of the guitar was sticking out. So I knew what it was. And I had about three strings by the time Christmas came around, because I had tweaked around with the pegs and all. Yeah, I started really, really young. And then piano around the same time. I learned piano actually first, and then I picked up the guitar seriously after.
Well, you played in bands as a kid growing up?
Yeah, I taught myself guitar, but then I ran across a great guitar teacher who actually happened to be my piano teacher's husband. He got it from my lap. I used to play guitars lying flat in my lap, because I always had, it just felt more, you know, it felt better to me to play it in my lap. But he made me sit it upright and learn the right way and how to tune the guitar. And then I went on to school, you know, in music school, and learned a lot more on the guitar and drums and sax and banjo. Yeah.
Some multi-instrumentalist then.
Yeah, it was great. You know, I went to one of those schools in Waco, the McLennan Community College, that taught a commercial music program, a lot like the Berklee School and the Conservatory of Music in Chicago. So we learned a lot of jazz and big band and, you know, arrangement and history of jazz and all mm-hmm. of that. And so there was this plethora of instruments always around. And every summer I would go home with a different instrument. And I remember the banjo not being very popular with my my mother.
Just because it's the banjo?
Yeah, I guess so. I loved it.
You joined the Navy then. So did you think, well, I'm going to be a singer, a musician? Or did you think, well, I need a backup here?
Yeah. It was more of a... I went to this music school, and that's all I spoke and wrote and walked and talked. And so I was looking for a break, really. And I walked into this Navy recruiter's office because I saw this guy in there, and he looked so relaxed. He had his feet on the desk. And I thought, oh, this is a place for me right here. So I signed up, and they needed welders and other things. And I thought, well, just sign me up. I'll find something. I really just wanted a break from music to see if I can even hold a conversation that didn't involve music. And I got shipped off to I went to San Diego. And worked around helicopters for about a year on the electric panels and all of that.
Did you give up music? I mean, you took...
I did. I just took a break. I bought a guitar in downtown San Diego, and I had that, and I would play that on my breaks. I sung at my CO's Christmas party one night, and he insisted that I try out for the Navy band. He told me I was in the wrong place. And I told him that, yeah, you know, I like music. Music's great. I knew it would find me eventually. So, yeah, I tried out for the band, and I got into the band. So I switched over to Navy band musician for the rest of my term.
Didn't that mean traveling or playing at ceremonies? Mm-hmm. And
yeah, marching bands. I was the... You know, I played either cymbals or drums, percussion, and marching bands. But we had a funk band that was a recruitment band, and we would play all the high schools, and I was a singer in that band.
Oh, yeah. That's wow.
In Charleston. I was stationed in Charleston, South Carolina. And so I was the singer for a top 40 funk band. Yeah, we did Keith Sweat, you know, all funky tunes with horns. It was fun. I learned how to travel. With that, the Navy Band Pride was the name of our band. Learn how to travel with seven guys and not lose my mind. And it really got me ready for what I do now. You know, I travel all the time now and play music.
Well, let me play another cut from your new CD. This is the song that you wrote, and it's called Open Sky. Mm-hmm. Let's just listen to a couple of minutes of it, and then we'll talk.
Okay.
Close out today's Memorial Day edition of Radio Times with the song Open Sky from Ruthie Foster's new album, Joy Comes Back. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Bilder, Trine Nuri, and John Ahrens, who edited this show. I'm Artie Moscowane. Thanks for joining us. Have a great Memorial Day.
Every little